This is a podcast from Shooting People.
Well, hello.
Hello.
Congratulations on your life. We're particularly thrilled to have the book that Christine's written, not just here to kind of sell to you guys afterwards. It's the most incredible kind of... incredible read that I do say it kind of gives you heart attacks along the way. And so I guess I just wanted to start by saying, why did you want to tell this particular story?
The first book I wrote, which was called Shooting to Kill, I was actually approached by a literary agent who, you know, asked me if I'd be interested in writing a book. And in some ways, I was so flattered that somebody thought I had something worth, you know, putting on paper that I immediately said yes. But as it turned out, that first book, which was kind of somewhat of a how-to manual and a little, and also kind of a diary,
Yeah. It
actually ended right at a point when everything really changed for us, because it took me right up to the finishing of the production of Boys Don't Cry. And then, of course...
And you won the Oscar, by
the way. No. We had literally finished... In fact, the film wasn't even called Boys Don't Cry in the writing of the book. It was called Take It Like a Man, which I still think was kind of a better title.
Good.
Do you know why we had to change it?
No, why?
Because Boy George had written an autobiography called Take It Like a Man that New Line had optioned to be a film,
right.
And they had registered the title before we had it.
Right.
Of course, that never turned out to be a film.
Yeah.
But anyway, it always felt to me like I had gotten up to a certain point with Shooting to Kill, and that I really needed to write a book about what happened. You know, the Oscar changed everything for us. It really did.
Well, I wanted to, because you guys haven't yet read the book, I wanted to just kind of touch very quickly or briefly on what still feels, though, like a very kind of core... part of your kind of production life, and that is your relationship with Todd Haynes, which, you know, started very, very early on. You went to Brown's and you met him there. And I kind of wanted to ask you, when you kind of met Todd, obviously that was a kind of time of real political and sexual upheaval. AIDS was kind of around. The 1980s was also a kind of time when it feels like the indie scene was quite fragmented. And I kind of wanted to understand just kind of for these guys here, if you could just kind of set the scene a little bit for what that time was like when you guys busted out with Poison, and then what the landscape might be now.
I mean, Todd made a movie that I hope some of you have seen called Superstar, the Karen Carpenter story.
It's hidden, it's online.
But, you know, it's awful quality. Not that that should stop you, but it is awful quality when you download it. And it was, he made that movie... really, in the late 80s, I think in 1987. And the thing about it is, you know, it is the Karen Carpenter story. It's told with Barbie dolls, which is a great joke. So when the movie starts, you think, wow, this is going to be hysterical. By the end of the movie, you can't believe what a great performance these Barbie dolls have given. And it was such an extraordinary feat that he pulled off. Making a film that was at once, you know, provocative, emotional, moving, funny. And so when I saw that film, I really thought, well, you know, I have to make sure that every other movie he ever makes has my name on it.
And you have.
I have. But the thing is, like,
There
was a lot of people asked questions about the whole new queer cinema thing.
Yeah.
And I keep feeling like what keeps getting left out of the equation in... new queer cinema and what happened to it and where are those people, etc., is the idea that is AIDS and the idea that there was such a sense of urgency and a political or emotional imperative for people to tell their stories.
And that had a huge effect, presumably, on the cultural production in relation to the kind of films that you were making. Did it? How did it kind of impact on the kind of landscape of indie film? I mean, was it an easy journey for you guys to be making those films at that stage?
Well,
how does it compare with the landscape now?
I mean, you know, I have to talk specifically about my, you know, about the States, because
that's
even though the movies, I should add, all we shot 4 movies this summer, and only 2 of them were in the States. One was in Barcelona and one was in Montreal, and all four took advantage of all kinds of global financing schemes. So it's really, you know, it's for most filmmakers these days, for most film producers, it's never been more of a global economy. But still, going back to when I first started out, you know, I didn't know from European soft money. I didn't, you know, and it was, nobody did.
Yeah.
And I think in those days, also in the States, there was a lot more arts funding, subsidized funding,
right,
that really doesn't exist now. Okay. So a lot of the early films I made took advantage of those kinds of things. There were also financing schemes that really had gotten very strong under Ronald Reagan,
right,
that were, you know, ways in which, you know, various tax funds could be written off if they invested in films.
Yeah.
And usually most of the investors in a lot of my early films had the same last name as the directors, but, you know, it worked. So
what's the landscape now then? I mean, in the book, Christine kind of comments that, you know, you couldn't get a go fish up now.
Well, I'm not so sure about not getting a go fish up. What I'm really curious about is, would people go to see it?
Right.
Because that's really what it comes down to. It's not about what it takes for you to make it.
Mm-hmm.
It's about, once you make it, are they going to go?
Yeah.
And a black and white, largely experimental film about girls getting together, I'm not sure. Because there's more choices now.
Right.
You know, if you're a gay woman and you want to see yourself on screen, you have a lot more opportunities to do it. And one of the tricks of a movie like Go Fish, or of Poison or Swoon for that matter, was how many people went to see such pretty intensely experimental films who wouldn't have otherwise.
So has the culture for experimental films died now, or have we just got more choice, potentially more opportunities in niche markets, and we just have to find them?
I think it's both. I think it's just that there's so much more. I mean, you know, there's, I don't know how many channels you guys have here. We have thousands.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's so daunting to turn on the television that, you know, because
yeah,
it's just...
You're run by pay TV, though, aren't you? I'm kind of in here, we're kind of run by public terrestrial TV.
Yeah,
think,
yeah, we're not public.
Right, yeah, public, whatever. It's kind of community TV.
We're capitalists.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So it is, but what that does mean is there's at least four channels in New York City that are dedicated just to gay programming.
Right.
There's at least four channels dedicated just to independent film programming.
Yeah.
So it's just, you know, there's all these different kinds of outlets.
So given that there are these ones...
And there's Netflix.
Right.
Which is a
sure,
very big deal. And I don't know if you guys have
We
this.
Do. Our equivalent is Love Film, which we kind of are supportive of here.
But
yeah,
the big deal about Netflix isn't that they're renting the DVDs.
Yeah.
It's that every time you rent... you're put into a database. It's like, you know, this person rented Todd Haynes' two films, a movie by Greg Araki, you know, two films by Alexander Payne.
Mm-hmm.
So every time you sign on again, it hones your profile a little bit more, and it
mm-hmm.
offers you films and things you will like.
Well, maybe that's good for us.
I think it's excellent. I mean, it might be a little big brothery.
Yeah.
But the fact is, it's a building, this base of people who are, you know, who you know are your audience.
Yeah. I mean, I wanted to kind of, it's interesting that you kind of talk about there being lots and lots of different channels with different kind of content, because content and the kind of content of your films was something I kind of wanted to ask you about. And, I mean, it seems clear to me that a lot of your interest is in, you know, really horrible things that people do to each other.
Absolutely.
There's that. and also a lot of the films, there's a lot about kind of sexual transgression. And I kind of wonder whether you think things like these five channels or the L Word, Queer as Folk and all the rest of it, whether that's kind of opening up opportunities for audiences to imagine different kinds of stories, or whether you think it's just kind of straight commercialization.
Oh, but see, I never have had any problem with straight
commercialization. Yeah.
I mean, honestly... I remember when Go Fish came out, I was asked, like, how do you feel about the fact that, like, there's probably some man who goes see that, you know, probably because they want to see girls get it on. I was like, fantastic.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, take what you can get.
Yeah, no, I'm kind of interested in then what are the new stories that might kind of emerge as different kinds of content start to get in the mainstream, whether that means that new stories can kind of be imagined or whether or not.
I'm sure that there will be. I think that we always romanticize, or I tend to. You know, when I came into when I started producing films, and it was a small group of people who were producing films in New York City, and now all those people have come up and have done a lot of extraordinary production.
Yeah.
But I know that there's a group of filmmakers whose work I don't know. You know, because they're making movies for their peer group, and I'm not that peer group.
Yeah.
And they're showing them, they're distributing them in ways that I don't really necessarily have access to. And I hope that's happening.
Yeah.
Because that's what should
somewhere
be happening.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I don't really know.
Okay. Well, I mean, one of the other core things that just comes through so, so strongly in the book is Christine's, I guess, killer films, the kind of ethos that they have in relation to the films that they make. And I just wanted to read a really kind of quick quote, if I may, which says, "But guarding a filmmaker's autonomy and agency to tell unconventional stories, to cast the right actress, not the star, to reject studio notes, to cut a third out of the movie right before delivery date is everything, since those values are what make film art, an art form, and not just entertainment." Very strong ethos. Does it work out every time?
Well, I mean, I guess it depends what you mean by working out. Because, I mean, what would really be working out is if the director walks away from it and says, this is absolutely positively exactly what I wanted. No compromises, like that ever happens. But you never know. It might. And the film goes on to make, $120 million at the box office. And usually all of those things are in between. I mean, somebody said to me, but how do you know when you should compromise?
Yeah, when you cut loose, when do you fight?
Yeah, how do you know?
Yeah.
And it's a simple question, but it's also everything, because the bottom line is, you have to know at some level. When I enter into this extraordinary contract with a filmmaker to get his or her film to celluloid, or not, to whatever is we're calling celluloid these days, I have to believe that we will together be able to decide to figure out when we're cutting into an artery. I use often the example of Boys Don't Cry and Hilary Swank playing Brandon. Now, it's unfathomable to imagine not knowing who Hilary Swank is, but at that time, no one knew who she was. And we had a lot of fights with the financiers because they wanted us to cast a known actress in that part. But it was really became clearer and clearer from a creative point of view. It wasn't even just that Hilary was the best person for the role, which she undoubtedly was, but it was became clearer and clearer that Brandon had to be played by somebody who had no baggage, that the audience wouldn't sit there and go like, oh, that's that girl. They had to, when she walks onto the screen, they had to feel the same way the people in the town did. Like, who is this person who just came to town? And that was incredibly important creatively, so we adjusted the budget accordingly.
Right, so in that case, you'll take less money for more kind of creative control.
Well, it depends what kind of creative control.
Okay, in that particular instance, that was important.
A very similar thing happened on Todd Solondz's film Happiness, which was, we were having some pressure to cast stars. Now, when I think back on it, I don't even know what any of us were thinking. Like, we were going to get a star to play a pedophile. But that's what that's what the studio...
Nice
and it was
thinking.
A studio film. That's the thing you have to remember about Happiness.
Yeah.
It was made by a subsidiary of Universal.
Wow.
Now, they abandoned it later, but during that was a studio film process where those things had to be approved.
Mm.
And finally, Todd, to his credit, said, I can't go through, waiting for all these actors to pass anymore. how much can I make the movie for without having this kind of pressure? And they named a figure that was about half the budget we were planning on making the movie for.
And you did it.
And we did it, but it was a pain in the ass.
I mean, you talk. It's interesting you kind of bring up Boys Don't Cry, because you talk in a bit of detail too about the kind of problems that between, or the difficulties, challenges, so we show, between Kimberly Pierce and Hilary Swank, and also Kimberly Pierce having to kind of fight the rating at the end, and
right.
and kind of having to make changes in order to not get the SC1 rating.
She had to make so little change. I mean,
right.
I think I make that pretty clear.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, she did. I mean, that was a ratings battle with a good ending.
Yeah, sure. But I wonder, as a kind of extension of that, I mean, in terms of making the decisions about whether you cut loose or fight, and you kind of talk about wanting to be on the side of the director, are you ever in a situation, I mean, your ethos is so strong. I mean, you're a filmmaker's dream, as far as we're all concerned, but at the same time, you know, are you, presumably you're having to make decisions too that potentially go against directors?
Well, it depends what you mean by against directors, because if you mean...
What's the best thing for the movie?
Well, but it's not just that. Like, let's say on Boys Don't Cry, let's say, ultimately, you know, Kimberly said, which she did say at certain points, you know, I don't care if it gets an NC-17. As long as it's, you know, as long as I don't have to, you know, cut into my vision, I don't care. Okay, but what that means is the movie is not going to be seen. It's simply not going to be seen. I mean, I have fought that battle and won, and I've fought that battle and lost. And I can tell you, an NC-17 reduces the film's financial ability, which is, you know, some filmmakers say, fuck that, I don't care. I don't care if it, you know, returns to the investors, which, you know, I do care about so I can keep making the movies. But I understand, filmmakers say that, I understand where they're coming from. But any filmmaker who really doesn't want their movie to be seen, I don't believe in that. I don't believe in celluloid trophies. I really don't. It's too expensive a way to express yourself.
Yeah.
And honestly, if you really don't care if people see your movie, I kind of don't think you should be making them, because that's just not the kind of art form it is.
But maybe one of the more kind of nebulous areas too on Todd's film Far From Heaven, where Steven Soderbergh, I understand, had the kind of final cut. Was that a good marriage? Did that kind of work out?
Yeah, I actually did. Did he have the final?
Did I read that wrongly?
No. I actually can't remember.
Okay.
If I said he did,
I think he did. Right?
That may well have been the. I mean,
yeah. Sorry.
I just think that people look at final cut as like the ultimate protection, and
yeah.
It isn't.
Right.
Because ultimately, getting into business with people, it doesn't matter what you sign and whether you have final cut
right.
or
yeah,
steel
yeah.
or whatever.
Okay.
What matters is the people you're getting into business with. But on Far From Heaven, I think, you know, there's always a fear of a studio to actually give, you know, they're always terrified if we actually give the final cut to the director. What if it's 3 hours long?
Yeah.
What are we going to do?
Yeah.
So they try and spread it out a little bit. I've shared final cut before with Todd. I think I had it on Velvet Goldmine, and Todd didn't have it.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't really remember, because, again, it didn't really matter, because the fact that Todd had final cut didn't protect him from Miramax.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
He still
it's
got...
It's a brilliant bit in the book, the stuff with Miramax. Yeah.
He still got screwed, and, you know, it doesn't matter. And the fact Mark Romanek didn't have anything close to final cut on 1 Hour Photo, but
yeah.
he had a relationship with Peter Rice at Fox Searchlight that protected him and the movie, because it was not in Peter Rice's interest to alienate a director he cared about.
It's a really interesting point of view, actually, because it kind of feels like actually what you're saying is try and work with people you respect, where you feel potentially the same vision
yes.
for what you want to achieve is kind of there. And is that something that you try and do now, or are you in a...
Yeah, but, you know, I mean, we try and do that. I feel very strongly that money tends to have a very distinct personality, and
yeah.
it's great if you can, you know, match up the right money with the director. But at the same time, you know, if that's the only money it's biting, then they'll
yeah,
take it.
Yeah.
Yes.
yeah, pragmatist as well, number one. I wondered if there's anything, again, just to kind of look at the early days, if there's anything... that you wish you knew now, that you knew then, Is there anything that you've kind of
overall... wish that I knew that I knew then that I know now.
Yeah.
You know, in some ways, I really feel like one of the best things when you start out is not knowing anything.
Yeah.
Because it's so hard. And if I knew how hard it was to produce movies, I probably wouldn't have started.
Yeah. Your books are a little bit like that.
Well, they're a little too... I mean, maybe they demystify the process too much.
No, they're just kind of the kind of strength and passion that you have to kind of make the films that you want comes through so clearly.
But in some ways, I feel like it's better to be a little stupid because then you're more fearless. And that's what really, you know, can get you from point A to point B.
Mm. Do you feel, I mean, kind of again, coming back to what we're all kind of trying to do here, and for many people, a lot of the stuff that kind of comes through Shooting People Bulletins of people trying to get their films up on you know, relatively low money or trying to find more money to get their films up. And a lot of it is also about tending to kind of cast people with unknowns. And it does kind of feel like the indie film landscape is now full of a lot of stars. And how does this...
It's just, I mean, I was talking to one of my colleagues, Ted Hope, who's also a very prominent independent producer, and we were trying to figure out what were some of the single biggest things that had changed since we started. And he's like, cast. Like, you used to be able to cast whoever you wanted. When you were making a cheap movie, who cared? Who cared who was in it? So you could really go and look and find cool actors, and it was fun. And now the pressure, even on movies under $1 million, to have somebody, some kind of insurance policy, somebody in it that, you know, is a recognizable name, is enormous. And that's a real shame.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of wonder if that then, you know, is the thing that may help people raise the money, or whether in fact that ends up being more difficult.
It is difficult because, you know, the actors are aware of the power that they wield.
Yeah.
And, you know, and even in the, I think in this book or in the other, anyway, one of the books.
Ask me.
you know, Hilary Swank was unknown, but she... Her only experience had been in, you know, television shows and I think Karate Kid 3. So, like, the first day of production, you know, right before the first day of production, she said, you know, I'm going to bring my dog to Dallas. And I was like, well, what are we going to do with the dog? I don't think the hotel accepts dogs. She said, it's okay, the dog can just stay in my trailer. We were like, okay. You know, you don't have a trailer. and you know, it's really, that's, there is this big disconnect. We just finished a film in New York that with Bette Midler, and she was fantastic and she was a real sport, but it was also a little like, okay, I think I need to sit down and explain to you how different this is going to be from anything you have ever done, you know? I mean, yes, don't you? You'll have a hair and makeup artist, you'll have all those things, but the, you know, the perks are gone. Now, the Todd Haynes movie that we just did, which is I'm Not There, a.k.a. the Bob Dylan film, just shot in Montreal, it had an extraordinary cast. Richard Gere, Kate Blanchett, Heath Ledger, Christian Bale, Charlotte Gainsbourg. And those actors all worked for nothing, but they all got perks. So that was the exchange on that movie, was they all, it was, we were, you know, awash with trailers. And I mean, they'd probably say, oh, you think this was a perk. But that was, you know, that was the sort of the way that film kind of found its feet.
Mm. And do you think then that for people who are coming up and trying to get films out, that the hope for distribution is actually quite limited without those names, or do you think?
I don't really
understand the problem, though. So,
you're not young enough. I mean,
okay.
But honestly, nor am I. But it struck a chord. I don't know if it did any business here.
Yeah, no,
but,
did well.
But the business it did in America, it's, you know, I still hear 16-year-olds quoting it to each other on the street.
Yeah.
So, you know, at first you think they're stupid, and then you realize what they're referring to.
Right.
But I think that the great thing about independent film is its ability to still surprise. Like, you just, you know, something comes out of nowhere and you don't know. You know, nobody pegged it, nobody tracked it, you know. It tends to happen more with comedies, you know, for better or worse. I mean, Little Miss Sunshine, in some ways, is held up, and I really liked the movie a lot, but it is held up as, like, this discovery at Sundance, but it's an all-star cast, and it was made for $10 million. It wasn't made for $800,000 with, you know, in someone's basement, the way Napoleon Dynamite feels, you know? So it is a, that I didn't really think of Little Miss Sunshine as a surprise. You know, I thought of it as, I appreciate that a good movie is out there and people are seeing it. But it does amaze me that every year there still manages to be something that sneaks through that somehow hits the zeitgeist and people go see it.
Well, I mean, you guys have hit the zeitgeist, so, I mean, so it feels like you guys have hit.
Not like $120 million.
Okay. Well, then let's talk about distribution, because One Hour Photo, you made, I mean, it made what? That was how many millions did One Hour Photo?
It probably made through the world over, you know, over $100 million.
Over $100 million. That's pretty good. You guys didn't see any profit on that.
No. Nope.
Right. How come?
Because it was a studio film.
Right.
I mean, that's the thing. It's when you make a studio movie, there's a lot of benefits. You know, there's a great big safety net. And you know, it's an easier process all around, but you're not, a studio, when you look at their profit statements, you know, it's a huge machine. It's almost impossible to come out, you know, with extra at the end.
So you're kind of viewing the idea of an independent film through the kind of lens of the content, really.
Or I would say the vision of the director.
Yeah. Even if it was made for $100 million?
Depends on the movie.
Yeah.
I mean, if you could make $100 million movie that really was, you know, an auteur-driven film.
Yeah.
That,
yeah.
God,
that would be great.
You'd have hoodwinked a lot of people along the way.
Well, maybe I mean, the other flip side, I guess, of independent film is often the distribution, and how we can get films to be seen by audiences. And it's really great how much you kind of bang on about how filmmakers have got to be aware of their audiences. But it's always a kind of finding audience. I always find kind of quite tricky in a kind of nebulous area. So, I wondered if you could elaborate on your thinking.
Well, I mean, first of all, you guys still have film subsidies here.
Yeah.
And we don't have anything. So, and I think it's a mixed bag, because in some ways...
Well, we quite like what you guys do, actually.
We wouldn't mind the subsidies.
Okay.
But I mean, what I do think it forces us to do is the only way you get to the next one is if you get people to see the one before. And knowing your audience is a big... You know, it goes back to what I said before. It really rubs me the wrong way when filmmakers say they don't care. And a lot of filmmakers, especially ones who come from heavily film-subsidized countries, say that because in some ways it doesn't really matter. It doesn't matter if people go see their movies. I think it is also the number one thing that I get when I'm sitting in the room with the studio executive and I'm pitching this movie. They go, this is what they say to turn me down. They go, I love it. I just can't quite see the audience for this. Now, in some ways, what's been a real boon for us has been HBO, you know, which we made Mrs. Harris and the notorious Betty Page for, because they have a different relationship with the audience. You know, it's like HBO can absolutely promote the hell out of something, and you know, get that those, you know, what they're interested in is if they put up enough billboards, you know, for Mrs. Harris, for example, that they're going to get more subscribers, that people are going to call up because say I want HBO so I can see Annette Bening and Sir Ben,
And
Sir Ben Kingsley.
It is Sir Ben.
It's always Sir Ben.
We had to write a memo. But you know what? John Waters actually said, because I complained, I said, I can't believe Ben Kingsley says we have to call him Sir Ben. And he was like, you know, all my actors have weird names, like Mink Stole or Divine. He's like, maybe it's his drag name. So I saw his perspective on it. But so you realize, like, these great cable premieres, I mean, I am starting to feel like it's now the fight to get movies, to get them into the cinema.
Yeah.
And to get them to stay in the cinema, because that's really what it comes down to. The kind of movies we make are movies that should, and I say should, in the best possible world, and that world's over, but they should be able to build audiences. They should be able to be sitting in the cinema for a week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks. People go see them, they talk about them, and then gradually people are like, hey, you know, that's really cool. I mean, when I was a teenager in New York, there were movies that would sit. Do you remember that movie, The Gods Must Be Crazy?
Yeah.
That movie sat at the Paris in New York, the theater on like 57th Street, for like a year and a half.
Yeah.
That would never happen now.
Well,
you know?
It's kind of interesting, because it's something that's at the very heart, I think, of, I mean, it's always in the kind of debates that are coming out through Shooters. And Penny, in fact, from Shooters, has set up a distribution label, which we called Word of Mouth, in the belief that... while the kind of windows for independent film have absolutely kind of been squeezed so tightly, that actually it's through online communities that actually we can generate instant word of mouth,
mm-hmm.
or that we can start to generate word of mouth in the way that maybe it used to happen in the theatres, but now we can do it very fast and online. And I just wondered whether you know, what your kind of views are on alternative methods of distribution, and whether the theatrical is still the kind of...
Theatrical's no longer the holy grail.
Yeah.
I mean... The problem is getting filmmakers to understand and believe that too, you know, because for so many directors grew up thinking like, well, you know,
yeah.
a theatrical release
yeah.
was
it's nice, yeah, it's really nice, yeah. Mm. Okay. Well, I can see Romney's kind of waving at me, so that means that I get to open up to you guys. But I wonder if I could ask just one more question, which is, are there any stories that are really libelous that you couldn't put in the book that you can tell us because we love you?
You have all these cameras on me. No, I have a lot in the book, though.
Okay,
yeah.
It's true. It is. There's an extraordinary amount in the book. Yeah, that's true. I'll hand over to you guys. What question would you like to ask Christine? Yeah?
It seems like a lot of your choices about what projects you want to get involved with are director-driven. Have you ever... decided to get involved with the project based on the script or even the story?
Absolutely. In fact, a couple years ago, I was approached by Nev Campbell and Barbara Turner just with a pitch about a ballet movie. And we financed the script. We had no idea, you know, I mean, it was not, again, it wasn't exactly the most commercial idea necessarily in the world, but I liked it. So we financed the writing of the script, and then we brought it to Robert Altman, and he directed it. That makes it sound a lot easier than it was. but the outcome was the same. And so we do that. I mean, the writer-director thing has definitely been our bread and butter.
Mm-hmm.
But I'd say we're moving now. That's probably about 70% of what we do as opposed to 80 or 90%.
That's interesting. And your instincts, do you feel now... tied more closely to the market, or do you still kind of use the same kind
of
gut?
No one
does.
There's no market. I mean, we just go. I never pick a script saying, oh, you know, what the world needs right now is, you know, for me it would be like, what the world needs right now is another movie about vicious child abuse and a psycho killer lesbian.
No,
we don't do that. We don't do that. I don't know. I mean, that's a hard question because, you know, a first-time writer isn't going to get to me. They're going to get to my staff. And really what I think is one of the most valuable pieces of advice I can give is don't try to get to me.
And don't try to get to the people in my position at these companies, because it's not going to happen. What is going to happen is most people like me are smart enough to know that you do have something to say. It's just we're too overwhelmed with the things we have going on to be the one on the front line. So we make sure that we have people who, I mean, the people who work for me, if they let somebody slip by who they shouldn't have, they hear about it. So I have people who work for me who are all about talking to you, listening to you, hearing your pitches. So when you're going after a company, whether it's me or Good Machine or Green Street, I'm just talking about the American ones or the only ones I know, bear in mind there is somebody there whose job is absolutely to talk to you and know what you're doing. And if you try and bypass them to get to me, you're just going to piss them off. And I'm not ever going to take your call, no matter how fantastic your project is, because I have just too many other things to do. So don't start at the top, because the bottom in these companies is actually where it's at.
Anybody else? Don't be frightened. At the back.
Yeah, given the kind of changing environment showing your product, what's your feelings about the future? Because obviously, I see the demise of British television because people don't watch it anymore, the internet, etc., etc., etc. So how do you feel about how you're going to get your product and get a return on that?
You know, it's a continual question, and I try to, you know, I'm essentially extremely optimistic. I try to change with the times. That's my mantra. It's constant, you know, like, you gotta change, you know, it's like, you can't lament the fact that you're the theatrical district, you gotta move on, you know. Oh, no more shooting on film, gotta move on. You know, you have to kind of go with it. So I try to see it as like an exciting thing. Like, the bottom line is, we know people want stories, right? I mean, that is what people do to relax, to have spend time with their friends, to really, they want to identify with people like them or not like them or completely they want to see those stories on screen. So is that going to be their computer? Is that going to be their television? It's probably not going to be in a dark room anymore with a whole bunch of other people. I mean, not so much. No matter how romantic we think, and I certainly have a lot of romanticism attached to that experience, but that's just not going to happen so much anymore. So I guess the answer is, I don't really know, but I'm running after it as fast as anybody else.
I'd like to talk about any distribution struggles that you've had with your films.
How much time do you have?
I know, but any kind of, and obviously there's a lot in the two different books that you've written, but obviously that's an absolute key thing. And is that something that you consider, from what you're saying, it sounds like you don't consider that from the outset, but obviously if you can't get a film distributed, it's...
No, we do consider distribution. Hey, can everyone hear the question, actually?
No.
Sorry. Okay. She asked about distribution on the films, and do we consider it from the outset,
and
any struggles that we've had. You know, we usually these days go into production with the North American rights already sold on a movie. We didn't used to. We often would take it to market in the past, which was kind of fun, you know, because then you take it out there and see who bought it, and it was sort of part of the, you know, part of the game and the gamble of didn't always pay off. It did hugely on Boys Don't Cry, didn't on Party Monster. But I mean, it's kind of part of the fun of the gamble of making films. Now I think it's like, you, even if we get a film, a North American distributor for a movie early on, that's just one small piece of the puzzle. Then it's about the release at the right time. And it used to be conventional wisdom was that independent films should come out during the summer to be counter-programming to the tent poles. But now that's kind of changed because it's all about coming out in the fall mm-hmm. and being part of the, you know, awards race. But now, where there used to be, you know, 30 films racing for the awards, now there's 60. You know, it's mm-hmm. it's just, so everyone's rethinking it again. And then a movie will come out, like Little Miss Sunshine did do a very effective counter-programming by coming out this past spring, and it stayed in the theaters all through the summer. Actually, it came out in July.
Yeah,
But that was really great to see that old way worked again. But now they really want to be in on the awards too. So it's kind of like, you know, you just never really know what works until something works, and then everyone gravitates towards that.
There's a lot of detail in the book, certainly, about the kind of Party Monster kind of fiasco, slightly, where they ended up just being distributed by Blockbuster. And not getting it. Well, I think you ended up getting a kind of small theatrical.
Small,
I saw it
yeah.
in the cinema, so
small,
yeah, it got a theatrical release. But I mean, presumably, when you're making your films, you're trying to tie up distribution up front. I mean, before you move on.
If you can, it's great. But the Todd Haynes film has no North American distribution. Mm. You know, it's kind of unbelievable. But it was a sort of a financial decision.
Is this the Bob Dylan?
Yeah, it was a financial decision to wait because it would be more lucrative once.
Okay, so strategic decision.
Oh, it's strategic,
not, yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. What else we got around?
Yes.
Have you ever worked on something from development, saw it through in a way that really surprised you?
Oh, it always surprises. Oh, sorry. Have I ever worked on anything from development and saw it all the way through and did it really surprise me? And everything surprises me. You know, you just, it's, that's the only reason why it's fun.
Yeah, up the back, we can see your hand.
How important are film festivals?
Yeah. Depending on the film, often hugely important. I mean, if a film, it's a way for a film to go to market. Which, you know, traditionally happens, you know, a lot at Sundance and Cannes, and then Toronto. It's a way for a film to start, you know, building an early buzz. Often films will go to a film festival and have an enthusiastic reception that no one had anticipated. Mm-hmm. Often it'll be the other way. So, you know, they can help and hurt. I think, you know, particularly for short films, film festivals really are their main way of having any kind of life. So then, in that way, they're much more hugely important. But, you know, for example, 1 Hour Photo didn't do much of a festival circuit, but didn't really matter. It had a huge star and was backed, you know, very heavily by Fox Searchlight, so film festivals weren't that big a deal for it. You know, for Boys Don't Cry, obviously, getting discovered at Venice and then, you know, going from Venice to Toronto was a big, big deal in its life.
Mm. I mean, it's kind of interesting, too, when you look at, I mean, in the UK here, they've been pumping money into script development for the last kind of 3 years, and loads and loads and loads coming going into script development. And kind of recently, it feels like there's a lot more money going into producers, or at least kind of understanding not just how to be a producer, but also how you can stay afloat.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if some of these alternate distribution paths, whether you're cutting deals, maybe you're not, with the likes of Netflix or Video On Demand or any of the other kind of distribution, whether you feel like there's opportunities there that can actually enable people to get some of the back end back through alternate routes.
There probably are. I mean, we haven't done that directly yet.
Right.
But, you know, because we still... Killer still goes through a distributor.
Yeah.
I guess what you're really saying is, when is the time going to come when you don't? Mm. When you just cut the deal directly?
Yeah.
You know, with the people who are putting it immediately into people's hands.
Yeah. I mean,
as opposed to the middleman.
Yeah. It is. I mean, I guess you're still in the middleman because you're able to kind of get into cinemas and do kind of quite big stuff that way.
Yeah, but I'm not certainly not adverse to to what that would be like.
Interesting. Guys, others?
Yes.
Hi. I'm involved in a film that's it's been completed, and it was shown at Cinequest, and it won an award at Houston. But since then, we've been struggling to find distribution. So I was wondering if you could perhaps give me a few tips.
You know, I mean, it sounds like you did everything the way you were supposed to. You know, and you even got an award. The fact is, you know, it's hard to know. The distributors don't go to every film festival. And sometimes filmmakers make a mistake in getting their films, accepting festivals that come after their movies without really researching the implications. Like, there's some festivals that if you show at, you can't show at others. And I've heard many filmmakers, you know, call me up frantic because they accepted Festival X and they didn't realize that meant they couldn't go to Festival Y, and now they want to turn down X, but they don't, you know, et cetera. So you really need to do your homework. And, you know, it's really, I don't know how to get a distributor if, you know, you kind of only get to show your film for the first time once. So you need to really make sure that is the absolute best time. You know, that it is the right festival for you. Now, you don't always have a choice. But once you've kind of been through that circuit, it's hard. I don't really have a tip, except maybe instead of going after a theatrical distributor, start looking more specifically at other means of distribution.
And there are some really fantastic, so I don't know if anyone knows the Arrive for Sale story. Did you know the documentary Arrive for Sale that was, who was it made by? Do you remember that? Really, a guy in the States who basically made a film called Arrive for Sale, which is kind of about how the money that is being kind of made through Dick Cheney and the likes of his kind of friends, where the real money for Iraq is going. And he kind of eschewed the theatrical distribution path because he kind of figured that most of the big cinema chains probably wouldn't take on a political movie like this. So he kind of set up a website where you could download, or you could buy the DVD, and he basically gave himself a week where he'd have his kind of theatrical premiere, which was that you would buy the DVD and screen it at home to like kind of 20, 30 people. And ended up getting a really fantastic week, and we ended up doing a screening ourselves kind of 2 weeks ago. But he had something like 150,000 people actually watched his film for his premiere in their homes. An awful lot more people probably that would have been able to kind of see it in the theatre. So I kind of think...